Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Christian Reformed Church itself is, I think, in some trouble. And now me saying that will probably get me into some of the trouble that you brought down upon yourself. But I've not been shy about talking about this.
There are so few liberal religious communities that are as creative and careful about the aesthetics of their experience as conservative churches are. And I always think, why do the worst ideas, in my view, obviously, have the best branding? That's not fair.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome along to the programme that brings you conversations that matter every weekend. I'm Justin, and a super interesting conversation on the future of godless and God-believing congregations in the West for you today. But just before we leap in, a reminder, there are two live events coming up you can be part of. Firstly, Ask Philip Yancey Anything on Tuesday, the 1st of March. The writer and Christian thinker joining me to talk about his life and ministry, and of course his autobiography, which came out last year, Where the Light Fell. He'll be answering your questions, and it's free to attend. Just register at unbelievable.live. And not only that, we've launched ticketing for our annual Premier Unbelievable Conference, Saturday the 14th of May, live from the British Library in London. You can be with us in person or online from anywhere in the world. And our theme is God Unmuted. In a confused and divided age, learn how the church can find its authentic voice again. Really excited to be joined by all kinds of people this year. Alistair McGrath, Jude Fields, Glenn Scrivener, John Wyatt, Sharon Dirks, just confirmed as joining the lineup, Bishop Joseph D'Souza, Sky Jatani, Phil Vischer, all helping you speak with truth and grace in uncertain times. Hosted by myself and Ruth Jackson, more guests to be announced. So do get yourself registered for Unbelievable 2022 and our Ask Philip Yancey Anything event you can attend from anywhere in the world. Just register at unbelievable.live. Let's get into today's convo. And it is my great delight on the show today to be welcoming two long-time sort of listeners and people who have, you know, been involved with Unbelievable over the years, James Croft and Paul Vanderclay. We're asking today, is there a future for godless congregations? James is the leader of the Ethical Society of St. Louis, the USA's largest congregation of ethical culture. That's a non-religious humanist movement with its roots in the late 19th century. However, in a recent blog post, he declared that ethical culture as a network was dead and that so-called godless congregations need to rethink their approach to community, activism and working collectively if they're to survive and thrive in the future. Well, that sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it? And today we're going to be asking, how much do these humanist communities have in common with many mainline church denominations that are also in decline in the West? And what exactly happens in a godless Sunday service anyway? Engaging with James today is Paul Vanderclay, someone I've been meaning to have on the show for forever, really. And today seemed like a good opportunity. So, Paul, welcome along. Paul is a minister in the Christian Reformed Church in North America, pastors a congregation in Sacramento, but keeps his finger on the theological pulse of secular and Christian culture through his very increasingly popular video channel. So really looking forward to this conversation today, James and Paul. The first thing I'm aware of, James, is did I even pronounce the place correctly? Is it St. Louis or St. Louis? I never quite know.
All British people seem to say St. Louis. I had to learn that St. Louisans say St. Louis when I moved to the city about 8 years ago.
Oh, there you go. Well, I stand corrected. The Ethical Society of St. Louis, in that case, But you're a Brit, of course, James. So tell us about how you ended up at St. Louis and yeah, just a little bit of a background of the congregation itself as well.
I'm going to try and keep this pretty short because it could be a very long story. But I grew up in Southwest London. And I grew up in a non-religious family. Neither of my parents were religious. They weren't kind of strong new atheist types, but they didn't go to church. They never professed religion in their life. And so it was never really a part of my life. And I never would have imagined when I was a kid that I would be leading a congregation as my profession. It just wasn't an option. It wasn't something I considered. But I got very involved in the humanist community at Harvard when I was a grad student. I graduated from Cambridge. I was a high school teacher for a little bit in London. I was a terrible teacher. I mean, truly disastrous teacher. So I retreated back to grad school and moved across the pond to the United States to study education. And there I found like that my religious views, not being religious, was just a lot less common in the United States than it is in England. And I felt the need to be around people who were a little bit more like me in terms of my religious values. And that drew me to the humanist communities on campus, which are pretty vibrant. There are a lot of non-religious people on Harvard's campus, and they've got some really great support, particularly from Greg Epstein, who I know you've had on the show, who wrote that book, Good Without God. He's the humanist chaplain there. And I got to know Greg shortly after I got on campus. And that community became a big part of my life. They were people who, you know, I went to when I was struggling with things. But I think a similar experience that many people would have with their religious community, this humanist community provided for me. I even ended up coming out of the closet to them on a service trip to New Orleans after Katrina. And so they really provided me with an extraordinary amount of support at a time in my life when I really needed it. And what I slowly realized was that the things that I was doing with that community were becoming more vital for me than my academic work, and they were where more of my attention was focused. And it happened to be the case that at that time we were trying to create a real congregational community for humanists on campus. It didn't exist yet, but we had an idea that there could be something like an analog of a church or a temple for people who were not traditionally religious but wanted a community based around shared values. And so I was part of building that community, and it became a real place. You know, for a while we had a real space where people would come on Sunday and we had talks and music. And I just loved the community that we were able to build. And so when I first encountered ethical culture, which is the very old fashioned name for the movement I'm a part of, which is a network of humanist congregations, I realized I could make a career out of what had become my passion. And I experienced a calling, honestly. I visited the New York Society for Ethical Culture, and I remember walking out onto the stage, gorgeous Art Nouveau, like dark wood walls and this beautiful plush velvet seats, and I had the most profound sense that it was my mission in life to fill it with people. And I had never encountered something like that before, the sense that I had a mission in life, and I knew exactly what it was. And that day, I inquired about training to become clergy in the movement. Leader is our very pompous term for our clergy. And that took me to St. Louis, where I completed my training. And very foolishly, they hired me to be first their sort of equivalent of an associate pastor. And then I took over as their lead pastor in the middle of COVID. It was a fantastic time to take over the leadership of a congregation.
Wow, yeah, what a time to be put in that role, gosh. Well, we'll hear about, you know, what that's all come to in terms of, you know, being a bit of a firebrand in what is obviously a very old and arguably, like many, you know, mainline denominations, aging, you know, sort of movement. And so this is partly why I was interested to have this conversation, because on reading that article, I just thought there are so many parallels here with so many churches and church leaders that I hear from anyway. And that was partly why I thought of you, Paul, not because you have a sort of aging and declining congregation, as far as I know, but you're very familiar with the issues that exist in this respect. Tell us a little, for those who aren't familiar with what you do, about the church you pastor, about your own ministry there, about what you do as well with the YouTube videos and everything else.
I'm the pastor of a little Christian Reformed church in Sacramento, California, that is very much declining, aging. Many Protestant small Protestant churches really have about a 60-year lifespan. I'm a third-generation Christian Reformed minister. My grandfather mostly pastored struggling little churches in the prairie. My father spent 36 years just outside of New York City in a mostly African-American congregation and community. That's where I grew up. I worked for 7 years overseas in the Dominican Republic and then came here to Sacramento, California to sort of a multi-ethnic, multi-everything congregation in this little struggling corner of Sacramento. I know a lot about church decline because I've lived through a lot of it. And yeah, listening to some of your stories, there are certainly a lot of things that do sort of map onto the church. So about 4 years ago, I've always been sort of a lifelong learner, and I blogged for a number of years. But then I watched the rise of Jordan Peterson, not so much in the culture war issues, but I began to notice that a lot of people listening to Jordan Peterson were leaving comments on YouTube and on Reddit saying things like, I used to be a fan of Sam Harris, and I watched Jordan Peterson's lectures about the Bible, and I kind of want to go back to church. And I thought, wow, I've seen a lot of one-way traffic towards atheism, and I see a considerable amount of traffic now coming the other way. And so I thought, I wasn't getting a lot of traction among my colleagues to talk about Jordan Peterson because it just didn't seem to make much sense. So I decided to make a YouTube video, which was totally new to me. And before I knew it, I had a few hundred, then a few thousand subscribers, and all sorts of people who wanted to have really significant spiritual conversations with me. And as the pastor of a small church, I think you can probably identify this with this. You can probably go quite a while without having substantive conversations with total strangers who wish to explore questions of faith, atheism, rationality, all these kinds of things. And before I knew it, I could do this pretty much 8 hours a day every day of the week right now, thanks to YouTube. So I've been continuing to do commentary videos on Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, Jonathan Peugeot, John Vervaeke, a bunch of other individuals like that, and yeah, it's just continued to grow. But at the same time, even though I have 1,000 or 1,500 people who will listen to the rough draft of my sermon on Sunday, especially in these COVID times, there might be 10 or 15 or 20 people in the room behind me. So I appreciate the kind of world you're living in.
Yeah, yeah. It's such an interesting one. And I don't know, who knows, you know, until we're sort of a bit further through, you know, the tail end of this pandemic, if we can call it that, then we'll maybe see what that does to, you know, in-person congregations generally. But I just thought it was fascinating to maybe bring you both together to talk about generally the religiosity, the way that humans have, you know, always congregated, whether around religious or, in James's case, non-religious kind of ideas. And in a way, James, you know, the ethical culture, which is the network of churches that you have the largest one of, and you spell out, you know, pretty frankly in the article you wrote, the fact that you feel, you know, there isn't necessarily a future for it. Now, I don't know whether that's changed. I know you did a follow-up article where you sort of said, okay, let's see if we can revisit this, because I think you had a lot of you know, interest and reaction to
I got in trouble
article.
Justin,
but first of all, yeah, I was going to say, I saw some not so pleased congregant members commenting on your Facebook feed and all sorts after you posted it. But either way, I don't want to get into the weeds of that. But tell us, like, what the background is to ethical culture, what the vision was in a way of these non-religious congregations being planted, and why that just hasn't, what your theory is for why it hasn't, you know, continue to thrive in, you know, in recent decades.
It really is a fascinating history, because the theory behind it, I think, is still extremely wise and valuable for the day in which we live. And a lot of the challenges that our founder saw in his age still persist today and suggest that there is a role for communities like this. But it was founded, our movement was founded by a guy called Felix Adler. He was the son of a prominent New York rabbi. and he was expected to take over his father's temple. And so they sent him when he was young to Germany to study religion. And like many young people, he sort of took a sidestep away from his parents' wishes. And he studied philosophy as well. He ended up studying more philosophy than religion, studied a bunch of Neo-Kantian philosophy. And in the process, he came to the conclusion that he couldn't intellectually justify belief in a personal God. And that's a bit of a problem when you're supposed to become a Jewish rabbi. And so he returned to the United States, and he was invited to give a sermon at his father's temple. And he gave a talk called The Judaism of the Future. And he sort of reimagined Judaism as a universal religion, so no idea of a chosen people with a particular revelation or relationship to the divine, based purely on ethics and right relationship between people. So he wanted to uplift what he saw as the moral character of the Jewish people throughout history as the thing worth worshipping, because that was really what he thought was the center of the religion. And thirdly, no reference to a personal God. And his father's congregation was not having that. They did not like that. He was never, in fact, invited to speak at his father's temple again. But enough of the members of the community were excited by the vision that he put forward that they got together to support him in developing something new. And that became the first ethical society, the New York Society for Ethical Culture. It was the Gilded Age. I'm not sure if anyone's watching the new Julian Fellowes TV show about that period in history, but you've got a lot of very wealthy philanthropists willing to give their money to social causes. And he ran in those circles. And so he was able to pull on very wealthy, politically and culturally influential backers. He was very charismatic. Everywhere he went around the United States and internationally, including across the UK, ethical societies sprang up. There were a number of them across England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. And so he was really a founder of a new religious movement. He saw it as a religious movement. He didn't call it non-religious at that time. So the late 1800s...
Would he have been behind the one in London, the Conway
yes,
Hall Ethical that, Society?
The Conway Hall Ethical right. Society was one of our congregations. It's now no longer really a congregation, but you see the sort of influence that our movement has had in the institutions it built. What is now Humanist UK grew out of the Federation of Ethical Societies in the United Kingdom. And the same is true of of Humanists International, the International Federation of Humanist Organizations. So he had an enormous impact on contemporary humanism because he was an institution builder and a community builder. He realized that religious ideas don't live in the abstract. They live in community and in institutions. And so he built the institutions to continue them when he wasn't going to be around himself. And so that St. Louis, the society that I serve, was one of the first to be founded. It's about 135 years old. It's, as you said, the biggest society. We have a pledging membership of 300 to 400 members. I forget how many adult members we have right now because COVID is very unusual. So I'm trying not to think about it much. And so that's a healthy mid-sized congregation, bigger than a lot of the traditionally religious congregations in our city. And my community is very healthy. But many of the 24 or so ethical societies that exist are very sick. They have very small memberships. They are, the membership is very elderly. That in itself isn't a problem. You can have a very healthy community of older people. Mm. But these communities are not healthy. They don't have a clear vision of the future often. They feel very worried about whether their community will outlive them, honestly. We've had real struggle planting any new congregations. We haven't successfully planted that many, really, over the last 10 years that I've been involved and beyond. And there's a sense of drift, you know, a sense that we don't understand what our role is in 21st century society. And one of the things I really appreciate about our founder is he knew exactly what he was doing and why he was doing it. You can read the founding address that he gave when he built the first ethical society. And it's just a very clear enunciation of important moral principles and the social role of congregations. And we seem to have lost that energy. And I wrote my article because I think that's very sad and that we need to do something about it. And I didn't see us doing anything about it. it made some people very unhappy. You saw some of those comments. Particularly people who thought I was talking about my own community, which I wasn't. My community is very healthy and I love it. And I think it's a model for other communities like us. Yeah. But it's so different to so many of the ethical societies I visit. The feeling is so different. You can, I'm sure, Paul, you understand, when you visit a healthy congregation, it feels a certain way. The connection between people, the love they have for each other, it feels like life, like you're walking into a life-filled space. And when you visit one that doesn't have that, it's like a void. It's like this sad, disconnected thing. And I just want the other ones to feel like ours, and I can't make it happen. So this was my attempt to say, to yell into the void and say, please come back to life.
In a way, you know, how many church leaders have wanted to bottle, you know, the vibe, the spirit, if you will, in one place and try and transfer it to another? But it doesn't always work like that. I don't know, Paul, if you've got any commentary on this, because, I mean, what's going on? I mean, I don't know what the overall state of your particular denomination is, but we know that many mainline denominations in the West, in the US, certainly in the UK, have been in decline for a long time. That's not to say there aren't exceptions to that within individual congregations, and obviously there are other church networks and denominations that are, you know, growing, and especially obviously in other parts of the world. But having said all that, you know, I do get the sense that a lot of what James described there, you could easily map onto, you know, certain congregations and church denominations in the West. So is it the same thing? What's the difference? What for you are the contributing factors to that sort of trend and decline?
The Christian Reformed Church itself is, I think, in some trouble. And now me saying that will probably get me into some of the trouble that you brought down upon yourself. But I've not been shy about talking about this. The Christian Reformed Church, I think, when my father in the 1980s was working with our home missions department, they set a goal for 400,000 by 2000. And right now, if the Christian Reformed Church has 200,000 by 2025, I think we'll be doing okay. So, and that is merit. I mean, the Pew studies have all shown that there's been a pretty precipitous decline even before COVID in church attendance in the United States. And the United States is, at least of the Western developed nations, exceptional in its levels of church participation. I think this is a topic of endless study for pastors and denominations presently. I'm fascinated by the story of your group, especially with its roots in Judaism. It all makes a lot of sense to me, given the cultural trajectory of the end of the 19th century and a lot of other movements that developed. And it also strikes me as interesting in terms of questions of, let's say, mythology, because as I look at now I just got off a conversation with someone who is typical of the Jordan Peterson journey, and that this person was a devotee of Sam Harris, and many American atheists work to excel in morality. But I think for many of them, part of the reason that they start getting interested again in the Bible, and sometimes even in very old forms of Christianity, such as Orthodoxy or Catholicism, is the embrace of a mythos. And I think at the 19th century, there was sort of an implicit mythos that developed that we don't need these stories. We can sort of embody morality purely. I mean, you see instantiations like Lady Liberty or Lady Justice, and they're quasi-godlike, but obviously in a secular context, sort of without a god. And so I think what we're going to see probably in the next 50 years is a lot of going back to mythos and trying to figure out how do our stories of narrative beings affect the cohesion of a community that can form around such a story. And of course, the Jews and the Hebrews were the foundations of this sort of thing.
I mean, that makes me want to ask you, James, what is it that your congregation gathers around in that sense? Because obviously in a Christian context, arguably, you know, whether a church is doing well or declining or whatever, there is at least a sort of central thing, Jesus Christ, that is the gathering point, the touchstone. What would you say is that thing that you know, that equivalent thing, I suppose, in your case?
Well, I think the way Paul put it is very insightful. I mean, I think that if you were to ask Adler, our founder, he did have a mythic account of pure ethics, right? He didn't entirely do away with the language of divinity himself. He got rid of the personal God, but he came up with this very weird, philosophically complicated idea of what he called the social divinity, which is kind of the idealized community. And so he had a mythic story to tell. And when you read his writing, he writes like a religious prophet. It feels totally different from secular humanistic writing. It has a different aesthetic quality to it. And over the years, our movement became quite disconnected from that way of talking and thinking about even our own values. We very quickly became sort of allied to American pragmatist philosophy that has a very different, very fallibilistic, very skeptical, very kind of hesitant mode to it, which I mean, I'm a pragmatist. That's my philosophical training. Intellectually, I'm all about it. I think it's right. You know, I think it's a very good way to get at truth. It doesn't really stir the heart, you know? I don't feel like anyone's read a book by John Dewey and been like, "Eureka, this is the moment my life has changed." And that's kind of what you need to sustain religious energy. And so I think that there has been that problem. I mean, I do want to caution us from thinking that this stuff is all important, because a lot of the studies show that actually the sort of theological beliefs and even mythic narratives of religious communities are not that important to members when they decide whether to join it. You know, when people research why people join religious communities, they often find that people are remarkably flexible about their actual religious beliefs. They're quite happy to hop the fence to a different denomination, even a different religion, if they find a community they want to be a part of. And so part of me wants to say, well, the community is the thing we're centered around, right? The actual relationships between the people is the central thing. But that doesn't quite satisfy me, because there are lots of different ways of organizing a community, and I have to lead them somewhere, and I do have an idea of where I'm leading people. And so it is a sense of the idea of human dignity as a fundamental value, of creating a world in which that dignity is respected. That's what we keep going back to. That's what we circle around. In what ways in our current society is the dignity of people being traduced? How can we find ways to fix that? Whether I express that in sufficiently engaging narrative form, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying.
Well, what I'd be interested on the other side of a short break is to get a sense of you know, what that looks like on a Sunday morning, you know, because as far as I'm aware, James, that's the typical time you do gather. So it probably, to some extent, I imagine, looks and feels a bit like, in some regards, you know, a church service, but obviously done in the way that you do it. So we'll come back to that. I'm really fascinated to hear kind of what a Sunday morning looks like at the Ethical Society of St. Louis. And we'll continue hearing from Paul Vanderclay as well. We're talking about, is there a future for godless congregations? Frankly, is there a future for some God-believing congregations as well? Because that's you know, those are the trends that we're talking about on the show today. And we're not here to depress you. I hope that in some way what we end up with is something that is helpful wherever you sit, whichever side of the fence you sit on today's show. But we'll be back in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. We're talking about godless congregations. In fact, James Croft leads one of the largest godless congregations, if you will, the Ethical Society of St. Louis, which is part of Ethical Culture, a network of these congregations. It's very historic, but has been dwindling over the years. And he wrote quite an interesting article, got a lot of feedback on it, saying perhaps the movement's dead. Perhaps we need to rethink the way that we do these kinds of gatherings and community. Engaging with James on that today is Paul Vanderclay, who himself is a pastor of a small church in Sacramento, but runs a very thriving YouTube channel looking at theological and cultural issues. And just in that last section, James was talking about the fact that in his view, community is really what it's about. And in fact, people are quite willing to, you know, jump ship to different theological traditions or even religions, you know, if there's a community to be had there. One of the things as well that James said in his article was people benefit enormously from being a member of a congregation. Since all religion is developed to meet human needs, the idea of a religion that is divorced from false and harmful beliefs is a good one, a way of returning to the human roots of all religious faith. So as far as James is concerned, you know, it's benefits all round if you can develop something that's truly ethical, in his view, and doesn't need the God factor. But what's your view on that idea that really it's community is what's attracting people to churches and so on, Paul? And the God thing, you know, could be arguably dispensed of. It obviously works in James's case. So what's your view on
that? I don't know that people are attracted to churches for ethical, high-minded reasons. I find that most of my members come to church in order to sustain often an ethical life, usually much more in the private sphere. You know, perhaps they have a difficult marriage. Perhaps they're struggling with a temptation or a sin or something even more broadly that's bringing them down, and they need encouragement to get through the day. And in order to muster that kind of resolve, you know, at least obviously in Christian terms, they need an encounter with their God. They need to hear from their God. They need to bring their gifts. They need to be encouraged by their people. Part of what I jumped into the internet fray for was that, in fact, I saw a lot of people were getting interested in listening to Jordan Peterson videos, enjoying online debate, and I saw they didn't have communities. And so actually part of what I've been working on is in some ways establishing communities analogous to what you've been doing, because I've started what I call estuary groups that are intentionally alongside the church, where people can be heretics or other things. They don't necessarily need to propositionally embrace a confession or a creed, but yet they need a space to talk about and to process what they've been doing. I think a big part of this is also the fact that in the United States, for example, even during COVID, we've seen a resurgence of all sorts of issue-based enthusiasm. If people are against racism, they might embrace Black Lives Matter. If they're for or against abortion, they'll embrace a cause. And I think part of the difficulty that a community that tries to organize around ethics per se is that whereas if there's a cause, they'll join. But in terms of sort of a sustaining thing, ethics, as we said before, kind of is like, well, of course, ethics, goodness, rightness, sure. But what? And so, again, I think probably the gripping thing for people, in my experience as a pastor, is Jesus becoming a focal point in which many of these issues can cohere. And what tends to happen is along the spectrum of, let's say, mainline to evangelical or fundamentalist, the different issues cohere in different ways, but Jesus remains the focal point. Then you have this strangeness that for one person, you know, Jesus, their love of Jesus might mean people should have the choice of ending an unwanted pregnancy. Whereas for others, it's Jesus that makes them rise to the challenge of more restrictive abortion laws. So I think there are a lot of issues going on in this with this question.
James, you may want to respond to that, but I also want to sort of get a sense of what does happen, you know, when you do actually meet on a Sunday morning. What about 10 years ago, I did a show that you'll with someone you'll know well, Sanderson Jones, who founded the Sunday Assembly. And there was a lot of sort of newspaper articles at that time of this sort of, you know, church without God meeting on Sundays. They sing pop songs instead of hymns. They have a comedian give the talk instead of a sermon and all of that. And everyone found it quite novel. But actually, you know, it's been going on for over 100 years, perhaps not in that specific style, but at least, you know, you're this, it wasn't like Sanders and Jones invented this. There's been forms of, you know, ecumenist congregations, you know, meeting on Sundays for a long time. So you're not the Sunday Assembly, but what are you? What does a Sunday look like at your congregation?
We're definitely nowhere near as high energy and as funny as Sunday Assembly is. I try, but I've never been a comedian like Sanderson. So, Sanderson's great, and I love the Sunday Assembly as an idea and as a movement. Before I get into that, I think that Paul said something really valuable, lots of things really valuable, particularly at the end of his last reply, where you were talking, Paul, about how, yes, religious communities do seem to have, or traditionally religious communities seem to have a center around which people are anchored. And yet, that doesn't, the values around which they're anchored, or the story around which they're anchored, doesn't necessarily neatly translate into specific ethical behaviors or actions. And indeed, people can have totally opposite views of what's right and wrong based on the same set of mythic narratives. And I think that that might reveal that it's not as simple as, you know, Christian churches get to unify around something really clear and powerful and non-religious congregations don't, right? It's actually complicated. And we have a range of views within our community about right and wrong, particular issues. And we also have a lot of commonality around the concerns and the way that we approach ethics. And it's not like there's nothing there. There are literally thousands of years of non-theistic philosophies to draw on, which have been grappling with many of the same existential, spiritual, and ethical questions that religions have always grappled with. So it's not an empty space. That said, it has always intrigued me, and this gets to your question, Justin, that the actual gatherings of ethical societies will tend to look very similar to those of many liberal Protestant Christian congregations, for instance. We've got music, we've got a main talk from a podium, we've got more music, we have a opening words from a member about why they're a member of the community. It will look like, honestly, a relatively conservative mainline church service. And one of the things that has always frustrated and confused me is the fact that, at least in my view, the most innovative communities regarding how they gather are often the most conservative in terms of the views that they espouse. Like, I like to go to religious communities to see what they do. I'm like a magpie. I love to go and steal their ideas. I'll steal, like, literature, flyers, like, anything they can give me, I'll take, and I'll be like, I want one of these for us. My staff think I'm absolutely insane for all the things I take from these churches. But I go to these mega churches in my area, and we have big mega churches in Missouri. And it's fantastic. I love it. The music is amazing. The lighting is sumptuous. The storytelling, they give these wonderful sermons and the music swells behind them and it matches the emotion of what they're saying. And I'm like, why can't I have this? No one's telling me not to, right? I don't have any theological, scriptural, liturgical reason not to be doing this. And yet I look like the Unitarians down the road already. I could be doing this in the 1800s. My stuff hasn't changed for hundreds of years. And so that disjunction is really weird. There are so few liberal religious communities that are as creative and careful about the aesthetics of their experience as conservative churches are. And I always think, why do the worst ideas, in my view, obviously, have the best branding? That's not fair.
It's funny, though. I wonder, James, here's my theory on this, okay? And it's generally true. I know this is a generalization, but, you know, if you just look at the statistics, in general, evangelical, more conservative churches tend to be attracting more members. I mean, there are still decline, even in, you know, quite conservative, you know, denominations in the US, I know. But having said that, if you look at where there is growth and where there is sort of large numbers, as you say, tends to be in more conservative ones. And those are the ones that tend to put on the biggest show, have the most probably engaging forms of outreach and everything else. Now, arguably, is that just down to the fact that because they're conservative, they think this is a life or death matter, whether you join our church. We will do everything within our power. Whereas someone who is a Unitarian or a humanist it doesn't actually, no one's eternal soul is at stake if they don't come to your church. And so it's going to make a difference as to how much, for want of a better word, effort you put in to kind of drawing people in. What do you make of that theory, James? It's just one that I think kind of makes sense.
You're going to make me cry, Justin. I mean, I really wish that I didn't agree with you, but in a certain sense I do. This is certainly not true in my own community. We spend a lot of time thinking about how we present the messages we present, who we invite, because something unusual about ethical studies is I don't speak every week. We have many different voices on purpose and many different types of music on purpose, right? We're trying to represent a diversity of ideas and of the creativity of humanity, which makes our job hard because we don't have an in-house band. I don't get to control the experience every time. But we do a great job, and I love the programs we put on. But that's not universally true of every ethical society or humanist Unitarian congregation I visited. And sometimes I am shocked about how little care I think is put into the experience that's being provided. Now, I've been to ones where I've felt insulted, because for me, it's funny. I understand why people who are traditionally religious think, oh, it's a life or death matter if you accept Jesus and are saved in this service. But for me, I just think, well, this is the one life we have. This is the only time we're going to experience this very moment together. Literally, what is at stake is the entire rest of your existence. How you choose to live will determine all the time that you have on this earth, and then it will be done, and you will get nothing else. And that really matters. So the experience we put in front of people really matters. So I've been trying for a long time to get my movement to take that more seriously. And I don't want to suggest that my colleagues don't take it seriously, because they do. They care. They've dedicated so much of their lives. You don't make a lot of money being an ethical culture leader, and you don't get a lot of support from a denominational body. You know, it's not like we're not flying around private jets and stuff. So these people really care, but somehow I don't always see that care translated into the craft which we use to share our message, and I don't understand that. So I kind of agree. I think I just don't know what to say.
Yeah, Paul, what would you say to this? Because I'm also conscious at the same time that, you know, we've just had big podcasts like The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill warning us of the dangers of the megachurch thing, and the fact that style over substance can very often be the problem. And so, you know, there's no, it's not as though one particular version of the church is winning. Often there can be some quite toxic things going on underneath anyway in those situations. But what, yeah, just interested in your response to all of these sorts of
things. Part of what you struggle with is you are grossly outgunned. I mean, in terms of Church Growth America, in the 90s, I did a lot of reading in church growth movement, and Lyle Shaler, who was one of the early founders, basically said, countercultural, meaning conservative usually, countercultural churches grow because, you know, if you don't have the prevailing winds of a political party or a culture behind you, you need a community in which to maintain your ideals and to have them reinforced and encouraged. And so countercultural churches always have more enthusiasm and energy. Part of what I think all religious groups are dealing with in a place like North America is we're increasingly competing in real time. Physical groups are competing against the internet. Like I said, I've got a church of 60, 80 people, and I've got an online following of thousands. And there, you know, a lot of people online think, well, when is Vanderclay going to give up his local church? And I keep telling them, no, actually, the local church is where it's at. And the online thing is sort of a hobby. It seems strange. The other point to come back around too, I think, even though it's very true that in religious communities, people will have a lot of fighting about how Jesus feels about LGBTQ inclusion or how Jesus feels about abortion, the idea that there is a Jesus and he has an opinion tends to generate or tends to energize the conversation and the debate and even the conflict in a way that I think, again, is difficult if you don't actually have a person who is deciding that everyone spends a great deal of time singing and praying their love to. So I think that's another part of there are many, many layers to what we're dealing with here, both religious and non-religious.
Mm. I mean, there's also been, you know, sociological factors at play. And James, you might want to speak to this because, you know, it's not as though churches are the only sort of organizational sort of bodies that have seen decline in membership, you know, political parties, you know, all kinds of, you know, social clubs and things. Generally, it seems like people are less willing to get up, get out and be part of a community, a sort of formalized community in that way. So I don't know, is this just sort of across the board? And if it is, what's your theory for why generally we're seeing that kind of change, James, in our culture?
Well, you're right that there has been a massive decline in all sorts of forms of civic participation over the last few decades. I mean, that's well documented in the UK, in the US, and pretty much every wealthy nation. You see the similar thing of less people going to church, less people voting, less people being a member of a political party or a union or a fraternal organization, if those even exist anymore. You know, you do see that decline. And of course, that means it's difficult in a broader culture where people are finding other ways to spend their time than connecting with others in a real space. It's very difficult to maintain membership of a congregation, for instance. And I accept that, and I recognize it's a difficult environment to work in. And sometimes when I have made criticisms of my own movement, people say that. They say, everyone's shrinking, and so are we. The problem I have with that argument is, firstly, also millions and millions of people, particularly young people, are leaving their religion. Right. So the pool of people who we could possibly draw from who might be aligned with our values is rapidly growing. And we're not seeing any of that growth. And I just don't believe there are more than 100 Christian churches in St. Louis. There's one ethical society. Right. I don't believe, or in London. Right. There are millions and millions of people who live in London. I don't believe that there aren't a few thousand at least who would like a community that like the one we create. And maybe that number shrunk from there were tens of thousands 50 years ago, and now there's 5,000 today, right? But even if that's true, we're only getting a tenth of those people. So we have to be able to do better than we are, even in the climate that we're working in. I mean, that's my belief. But it is difficult. Maybe we need to change many ways about how we gather. And I'm open to ideas. No one seems to have come up with the idea that's working. Maybe I should start a YouTube channel and that'll be it. But I still think that there's a space for these sorts of communities, particularly after COVID. I think people are hungry to be with each other. I don't think it's just me, but I have felt very sad about the fact that I never get to see anyone, and I go out in public now and I feel like I don't know how to do it anymore. How do you speak to other humans? I don't know. And I think that there is a yearning within the human soul to be together in the real space where you can see each other's faces and touch each other. And that doesn't just go away because of some demographic changes. I think that's part of the sort of animal that we are. And so I think we should be able to harness it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Paul? I really like what you said there. I wonder if part of what we're seeing, and you can see this in divorce rates, you can see this in lower rates of marriage, is that in our increasingly cyber-relational world, we are losing our capacity to maintain the kind of stable, formative, rigorous in-person relationships that previous generations were better equipped to do by virtue of the fact that they had to. Because one of the things that you recognize in terms of pastoring a local congregation is there's a fair amount of just teaching people how to get along. And I'm sure that's no difference in your group. And so I do wonder. Yeah. On one hand, I see people saying, boy, I really need more community in my life. Boy, I'd really love to have a spouse. Boy, I'd really like to have a fruitful, flourishing marriage. Yeah. Are you prepared for the kind of commitment, self-sacrifice, and work that all of that involves, especially with respect to an extended community like a congregation? Are you going to put your money where your mouth is? Are you going to volunteer your time? Are you going to give up Saturdays for cleaning the facility or doing a little bit of repair? All of this on top of all of the other commitments and pleasurable activities that people are pursuing. It's usually with the rise of affluence. So I think there are a lot of tiny little issues that are probably beginning to sum up in the diminishment of people's capacity to maintain voluntary organizations together.
And that's the interesting thing for me, James, is, you know, you say, you know, look at the big mega church, but you sometimes wonder how much community is actually going on, because the problem often is that there's a fantastic show on a Sunday, but not necessarily a huge amount of community going on alongside it. It's kind of people showing up for another entertainment spectacle, frankly. You know, that's always the danger. I know that that's, again, a huge generalization, but genuine community, you know, isn't even necessarily, you know, happening in some of these, you know, quote unquote successful situations. So yeah, it's I think in a way we're all, to some extent, we're all in the same boat, and we're asking, are we, you know, what's the clue, what's the key, how do you re-engage people who say they want to community, you know, feel that urge, but kind of their bed is very warm on a Sunday morning and they don't seem to make it into church. They can now watch online, you know.
Hey, I feel that myself,
be there in person.
Like, very often I'm like, do I really want to do this?
So what's the difference then? I suppose, I mean, coming back to you, Paul, part of me is thinking, look, James, you know, on an atheist worldview, let's say, I have a huge amount of respect for James just grinding and saying, I really want this to happen. And I don't believe there's a God out there who's kind of paving the way for me here. It's, you know, it's about making it happen. You know, by the sweat of my own brow, we're going to get people to come along to this. You, Paul, do believe that there's a God and a spirit that is somehow working in the background. And so it can't just be, how do we get bums on seats? There's got to be a sort of sense in which you believe there's a bigger picture at play, presumably, and that maybe do you feel like there's a, you know, around the corner there might be some great religious revival? You know, maybe it's Jordan Peterson's going to be the one who ushers it in, who knows? But you know, what's your feeling? Is it just a, because I can't believe that you're just resigned to the fact that, hey, this might be the end of the road for my denomination, or, you know, the church in the West, because of declining.
Well, my denomination isn't much older than your ethical movement. And I think that part of that's the difference. Whereas, you know, I have a degree of sobriety about my local congregation or even my denomination. I am completely optimistic about the future of Christianity. And I see Christianity as having had to reform itself many different times throughout its history, and especially being a Protestant. So in the Protestant Reformation, there was just a flurry of new religious activities and new denominations and new ways to instantiate Christianity all over the world. And Methodism comes through and reshapes it. And, you know, the Pentecostal revival at the beginning of 20th century just seeds churches all over the world. And I do believe that with all of the disruption and transformation that recent technological change, such as the internet, is causing, I see a lot of the work that I'm doing on the internet, hopefully as part of sort of prototyping what next iterations of Christianity are going to look like. Now, I'm 100% on the same page with you that I, even despite the internet, I don't think there is any substitution for face-to-face committed community. And I tell people, will often say to me, well, you're my pastor. I'm not your pastor. You don't meet in this room back here. I'm happy to be your friend. I'm happy to talk to you. I'm glad you listen to my videos, including my sermons. But a pastor is someone who knows your story and can smell your breath and can embrace you and can knit you together with a whole group of people that are like but different and can and can in fact be a body in Christianity, of course, the body of Christ together. And whereas I think we're going to continue to see a lot of disruption in the church, I do believe, and I'm seeing it in fact, that at least in my online communities, I see Orthodox and Catholic and Protestant and even non-Christians, and we're all gathering together. And I think one of the real forays in the future around what I'm doing with Estuary is I want the church to be a place where people can go for a meaningful conversation, not just a good show, not just a good sermon, not just some teaching, but much more interaction. And so, as I think we've been seeing in Christian denominations for a while that have been working small groups, I think small groups where people can actually know and be known, love and be loved, will be the future. But figuring out how to adjust institutions, that's going to take some time.
Yeah. Well, we may be, as you say, sort of in the early point of the next great, you know, sort of transformation. You know, the internet in the last 20 years has changed everything. And then COVID comes along to add another spanner in the works. And yeah, and you're right. I mean, 100 years from now, you know, what might the next iteration of Christianity look like? I want to come back to what the next sort of iteration of godless congregations may look like, James, and what your hopes and dreams are for your movement as well. But we'll do that in just a moment's time, because we're bumping up against our final break, and we'll finish off this conversation on the future of godless and God-believing congregations with my guests Paul Van der Clay and James Croft in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show, continuing the conversation with James Croft and Paul Van der Clay in just a moment's time. But if you've been hearing about our Ask Philip Yancey Anything webinar on the 1st of March, just wanted you to know I'll be hosting a separate follow-up chat with Philip straight after the webinar for anyone who wants to strategically support the launch of our new Premier Unbelievable ministry. We're going to be sharing our vision for the future. You'll get to meet Philip and hear more about how you could financially support our new plans and vision. You can just email me, drop me a line, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you can't make that specific date, but you'll still want to hear about our plans, still email. We'll make sure you hear all about it. Again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Also, if you're coming along or thinking of registering for our Unbelievable conference on Saturday the 14th of May, just to say as well, it's not just the conference. As part of your ticket, you get access to our big conversation live event going on that very evening as well. And I've got some really super exciting guests to announce for that, but I'm going to keep you on tenterhooks for a bit longer. But check out the registration page for all the details. That's at unbelievable.live. Okay, coming up later on tonight on The Profile, you're going to be hearing from Martin Smith. He's the former Delirious frontman, talking to Sam Hales about how his life, faith and music have all been changed by the pandemic as his new album Dancing in the Fire is released. That's also available on The Profile podcast, and you can read it in the February edition of Premier Christianity magazine. In fact, they'll give you a free sample copy of the magazine if you go to premierchristianity.com/free sample. Next week here on Unbelievable, Hinduism, Caste and Christianity. I'm going to be joined by Bishop Joseph D'Souza of the Good Shepherd Church in India. He's one of our conference speakers this year, as well as Kancha Elea Shepherd. He's a political theorist and human rights activist. They'll be discussing the plight of the Dalit and Shudra communities in India and the way that that's impacted the Christian church, and indeed the prospects for the Christian church in an increasingly hostile environment with the Hindu Nationalist Party in power at the moment. So listen out for that same time next week. For now, time to get back into today's show. So we've been talking about godless congregations. James Croft, leader at the Ethical Society of St. Louis, wrote this quite controversial piece. And I will just say, James, this is on a new website. Only Sky is the new sort of hub, really, for secular atheist voices. I know that a lot of the contributors who were on the atheist channel at Patheos have sort of moved over to this new one. And we heard about that a few weeks ago from another guest on the show, Jonathan Pierce. But This is where you're blogging regularly now, is that right, Only Sky?
They call me a columnist, Justin. I think they're trying to make me, encourage me to write more frequently by giving it that title rather than blog. But yes, I'm writing there. One of the things that appeals to me about Only Sky is that they're very interested in storytelling and narrative, and they want to get away from the kind of polemical, this is a bad thing conservative Christians did in America today kind of stuff that is is the meat of much atheist blogging. And that's got an audience. But I've always been interested in trying to ask the questions like, what does it mean to live this life without religion? And I'm trying to kind of lean into that with this new space.
Well, I will make sure there's a link to the article we've been talking about, and I'm sure people can go on and find out more there. PaulVanderClay.com, by the way, if you want more from Paul as well, and obviously search up the YouTube videos as well on YouTube. You painted a bit of a, as you say, bleak picture for the future of ethical culture. Your own congregation bucking that trend. What do you see as a future? And I know that subsequently, you know, after some interactions, you are looking at sort of whether there may be life in the old dog yet, as it were. So what's the future for you of your particular movement, James?
I think Paul said something very interesting when he talked about how Christianity has reformed itself many times. And he's confident about the future of Christianity, even if he's less sanguine about the, you know, where his own denomination is headed. And I kind of feel that way about what we do in the ethical movement. I think that people feel like it's much more of an existential threat because they think that in a sense, the late 1800s was the first time this was really done. And so if this chapter of the story closes, then the whole book closes. And I've never really felt that, maybe because I didn't grow up in an ethical society. And I came to it from sort of the broader humanist movement. And I feel like there will always be people trying to creatively come together and ask the biggest questions about life. And there will always be people who try and do that without reference to God or the supernatural. And what form that takes and what label we attach to it is less important than continuing the conversation that we've been having for the past 140 plus years or however long. You know, it's a lot longer than that if you look at the whole history of broadly humanistic gatherings. And so I think that I don't know, honestly, if my actual denominational organization, such as it is, will be able to turn around my own movement. I've been banging my head against that wall for the last 10 years, and it doesn't sound like a long time for many people, but I'm not quite 40 yet, so that's a quarter of my whole life. It feels like a long time to me. And I don't really see it turning around right now. And that is why I wrote what I wrote, because I wanted to be honest and say, at a certain point, you have to realize you're putting your energy into something that can't actually receive it. And then the task becomes, what new thing can you build together? But that doesn't mean the story's over. We've got a lot of talented, very passionate people. We have members all around the country who are so dedicated to their local communities. And I think they would be better served in their efforts by a new organization that was more little C Catholic in its approach, that didn't just serve ethical societies, but reached out to Sunday assemblies and Oasis groups, which is another network of non-religious congregations, and other people who were trying to do similar things, and said, how can we help you? What expertise do we need to build to grow communities like yours? And just shake off some of the shackles of expectation that come along with being part of a storied and influential movement. Because even though we've always been small, we have been influential in progressive political circles particularly. And I think sometimes the desire to hold on to the past prevents you from grasping the future. And I think it's time to let go and build something new.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and again, the similarities are striking there, Paul, because this has often been exactly the problem with many long-time mainline denominations where they've been shackled by certain traditions, ways of doing things, buildings very frequently, diminishing congregations that stop them being able to innovate. And, you know, these young, new denominations or networks that are kind of, you know, don't have any, you know, rules in place that they have to abide by can sort of, you know, do the creative thing and so on and take off. And sometimes, it's a Christian principle, I suppose, that sometimes things have to die in order to be reborn again, isn't it? And so is that, you know, is that something you're kind of just, as you say, just realistic about, that might be the future for some denominations, possibly even your own, but that doesn't mean the whole, you know, that the future is dead, that the future could be reborn in some way?
Very much so. And it's fascinating in America, for example, to watch the Orthodox Church come online here. The Roman Catholic Church really only came to the fore in the United States really in the 20th century, came to be, you know, find a degree of stability. So part of the difficulty is that as creatures who live 80 or 100 years on this in this world, our time span is pretty small. But we're living within institutions and within movements that go back a very long time. You know, if I continue to go until I retire, that will be 100 years of ministry that my grandfather, my father, and myself have participated in. So I've seen churches that we planted when I first came to Sacramento in the 90s. So we're sort of using a seeker methodology with big sound and popular music. And today, most of those churches have weekly sacraments and liturgies. And so I continue to watch these things change and reform. And, you know, part of the reason that I'm very excited about the future of Christianity is, again, I've seen it when I was a missionary in the Dominican Republic. I just watch Christianity transform, enter new cultural groups. They sort of find a new expression of Christianity within their cultural group, but yet there's still a thread to the other groups. So it's just part of my faith that in some ways, and especially as a Protestant, in some ways the wineskins sometimes wear out, but the wine seems to be transferred from one skin to another.
Yeah. James, you may not use, you know, a bit such biblical metaphors for your own situation, but I mean, at the end of the day, you sound, in a sense, just as evangelistic as Paul. You want your movement to succeed. You want to see people come on board. You believe this is good for, you know, people, for your community, for the wider world, and so that is enough to essentially drive you to want to see it flourish, right? You don't believe, you know, as you said, it's not about people's eternal life at stake, but it's this life that's at stake, and you do want people to in a sense take that more seriously, I suppose. You think there is a place for this kind of community, and presumably for you it would be a tragic shame if it simply stopped in any form in the future.
And it is, in a sense, people's eternal life that's at stake, in the sense that, you know, it's the entirety of their whole existence. So, you know, all 100% of their existence is still at stake. Yes, this is my whole life. I mean, this is what I've dedicated my career to. I chose this path because I felt like it was the way that I could use my skills to benefit my community. And it means an awful amount to me, and it's become constitutive of my identity in exactly that. I mean, I know a lot of clergy of a lot of different religious traditions who I've walked beside in all sorts of shared endeavors in St. Louis since I started this work. And we all have the same sense that our religious perspective is part of who we are. It's not just a job. It's genuinely a calling, and I feel exactly the same way about what I do. So, yeah, I mean, I hope it was clear, if the people who read my article were angry about it, that it came from a very sad place. Like, I am very unhappy to have to report the death of my movement, and I'm not excited about it, but the mission is bigger than any one community, any one person. You know, it's something that I say to my congregation again and again, that even though we might be gathered together to make relationships with each other, there is a bigger picture we're a part of. It doesn't exist just to serve the social needs of our members. It exists to transfigure the world into one in which people's dignity is genuinely fully recognized. We are not done until that job is complete, and I think we're going backwards right now. So if anything, the urgency is even greater than it was when this movement is founded. And so I would be sad if it stopped. The work won't stop because our movement stops. People will still find ways, but we have resources and we have an opportunity to play a role in the great conversation that's going on about what we want our nations to look like, what we want humanity to move towards. It's a very unsettled time, and we could be a voice giving some sense of moral clarity at a time when it's desperately needed. And so often we seem so unsure about what we have to say. And I want to wake people up a bit. So, I mean, who knows what will happen. But
well, we maybe we'll check in again in another 10 years.
Yeah, in another 10 years. Who knows? Gosh, I can't even think about that.
We'll all be worshipping at the Church of St. Jordan Peterson by then, you know. That'll be where we'll be.
I would rather join Paul's church than that one.
Anyway, it's been great chatting with you. James and Paul, thanks for just a really interesting conversation. One of those open-ended, just, you know, interesting chats on today's show, and I've really appreciated both of you. Links to James's article and Only Sky, the new website that he and many others are contributing to from the sort of secular and humanist side, paulvanderclay.com for Paul's channel, and where you can see more of his videos and blogs and so on. But
just make sure to block out your whole evening if you want to watch one of Paul's videos.
That's true.
Yeah, we keep these conversations like very short compared to Paul's.
We're still praying for you to embrace your inner Joe Rogan, Justin.
Oh, well, I don't know. I'll take the money. I'm not sure about the controversy, you know, with Joe Rogan. But anyway, it's been great to catch up with you both. Thank you very much. And I hope we can do this again at some point. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Look forward to hearing what you have to say about today's edition of the show. You can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via our social media. @unbelievablejb is my Twitter handle. You can find the show page at facebook.com/premierunbelievable. Look out for the launch of a new mini site for Premier Unbelievable, bringing together all of our podcasts and resources in one place. That's ahead of the launch of an even bigger, better website around the time of our conference in May, as we launch on a new footing Premier Unbelievable as a ministry, bringing all kinds of resources to bear. It's all about helping non-Christians to explore faith and Christians to understand, defend and share their faith with confidence. So look out for news of that. And of course, this year's Unbelievable Conference is all about helping you to do that as well. To speak out in an often confused and divided culture, God Unmuted is our theme this year. Live from the British Library in London, Saturday the 14th of May. Really excited that we've got Ruth Jackson coming back to co-host. So it'd be wonderful to have Ruth Jackson as she starts to return from maternity leave for this year's conference. Alistair McGrath, one of our keynote speakers, is going to be with us. Of course, he's a regular on the C.S. Lewis podcast from Premier Unbelievable, if you've had a chance to listen to that. Lisa Fields from the Jude 3 Project will be with us as well, coming in via video link. She does amazing work with her organization, helping to reach urban, racially diverse communities. Glenn Scrivener from Speak Life will be there. His new book, The Air We Breathe, is an amazing guide to the way Christianity has shaped the Western world. Just managed to confirm as well Sharon Dirks as a speaker. She's from the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. She's got a background in neuroscience, author of a great book, Am I Just My Brain? Joseph D'Souza from India will be with us by video link. John Wyatt, who's a doctor, author, research scientist, leading authority on bioethics, science and faith. He'll be joining us too. And he'll be launching a new podcast with us soon as well. So excited about that. We'll give you more details about that in due course. Phil Vischer and Sky Jatani as well, joining us by video link. So lots of interesting people, lots of guests. You can be part of it. Unbelievable.com. Live is the place to register, find out more. We've got in-person tickets. It is limited seating, though, at the British Library. So if you want to come in person, I suggest you get in there fast. Those tickets will go quickly, I think, for the in-person side of this conference. It's catered as well this year. We're giving you a meal while you're with us, because we're going right through to the evening for our big conversation event as well. But if you're online, you're going to get all the same material, all the same sessions, Q&A, lots of opportunity to engage. So do check out the ticket options at unbelievable.live. And of course, coming up shortly, our Philip Yancey webinar as well on Tuesday, the 1st of March, also available from that same website. And if you want to join us for this sort of the after party and hear more about the vision of Premier Unbelievable, as I've said, email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk for more details. Thanks to all those who are getting in touch with the show. A lovely message from Rebecca on Facebook, who said, hi Justin and everyone else responsible for making the podcast happen. Unbelievable has been an indispensable resource for me over the last year or so. For the last 4 years, since I spent multiple months in South Asia, I've really struggled with questions related to my faith that I couldn't find satisfying answers to. Unbelievable has not only taught me a lot, but it was also a comforting reminder that many people are asking the same questions and haven't given up on God because of those questions. Especially enjoyed your interview with Robin Parry, and it sent me into a deep dive into the Bible, reconsidering my perspectives on God's love and what the Bible says about salvation. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for what you're doing. Gosh, Rebecca, thank you for getting in touch. And well, you must be quite far back in the archives if you mentioned the interview with Robin Parry. I'm glad you've got so much out of the show as you've delved into the back catalogue. Coming up to more recent shows, we've got more of your feedback to, well, that, you know, barnstorming debate on the gay conversion bill, Peter Linus and Jane Ozan. David Robertson gets in touch. Been a while since we've heard from David. He has been a regular contributor to the show in years gone by. Currently down in Oz, where he's doing his work there now. But David says, long time no see, but I do hear you every week, Justin. Been meaning to write for a while. Thanks for the continued work on Unbelievable, which I still faithfully listen to. Always enlightening, sometimes really helpful, and occasionally frustrating. As an example of the latter, the debate between William Lane Craig and James White was frustrating. Right from the beginning, it became pointless because James White seemed to concede that Calvinism teaches that God is the author of evil. Calvinism specifically disavows that. For White not to mention that was astonishing. After that, the conversation became pointless and philosophical. But even more frustrating was the conversation between Jane Ozan and Peter Linus. I've no idea how Peter kept his cool as Jane continually harangued, interrupted, sneered, misrepresented, and accused. To hear Jane, a non-lawyer, lecture Peter, a barrister, on the finer details of the law was astonishing. It was, however, a revealing conversation, showing not two different kinds of Christianity, but the difference between Christianity and the progressive religion, which just uses the language of Christianity. Jane assumes that her views cause no harm, and anyone who disagrees with her causes harm. She has no qualms about using the civil law and police to impose her doctrine. She's already said that people like me should be prosecuted by the state for preaching and practicing the scriptures. Seeing how she reacted to the calm and rational Peter Linus shows exactly how she wants to treat all who dare to disagree with her. Come and do a show from Oz sometime. You have many listeners here. Thank you, David. Thanks for being in touch. We didn't really bring you much feedback from the show of several weeks ago now. Extraordinary claims. Do they demand extraordinary evidence? This was Jonathan McClatchy and Jonathan Pierce debating issues around miracles, but from a more philosophical perspective. So here's a few of the emails you sent in on this one. Ken Litwack said, thanks for arranging these great conversations. I was appalled, though, at Jonathan Pierce's assertions. I wonder if he's read Thucydides, Luke's Gospel, especially Luke 1:1-4, and Lucian on writing history in Greek. I have, and I think Pierce needs to do some research in how historians approached their task in Luke's world. Among other things, they're expected to provide moral education through the selection and presentation of the contents of their narratives. Pierce also sounded like he didn't understand what Thucydides was doing in his prologue in War 122. Some read this passage the way Pierce does, but I'm convinced Thucydides was ambiguous deliberately. However, he did not say he invented speeches out of whole cloth, or that he never consulted anyone. Second, Pierce needs to study how history writing is done at any period. It's always selective. It's impossible to not be selective. No one records and no one wants to read the exact details of one day in the life of someone else. The text would be massive and mostly massively boring. Pierce expects too much from Luke. And third, Hellenistic historiographers do not generally tell you where they got information from, but unlike modern historians, eyewitness testimony, especially that of the author, was crucial. It was far more important than written sources. Josephus and Dionysius of Hellenarsus are good examples of not mentioning sources. Luke tells us that he consulted with autoptoi, those who were or eyewitnesses or had first-hand knowledge. That was far more valuable in Luke's world than some document. And lastly, he reminded me of Bart Ehrman, take some small detail and build it into some all-encompassing viewpoint. I thought the old slogan, slightly revised, Ehrman, Dawkins, etc., said it, I believe it, and that settles it for me. I'd like Pierce to tell us how he knows with confidence that anyone in the ancient world existed. There are some statues and inscriptions, but why should we trust them? Most historical work is done based upon documents. I can't prove Julius Caesar existed. Can Pierce? We have mostly written documents. Why should we believe those and not the four Gospels? Pierce seems to work by a serious double standard. If he's disposed to believe the documents, he does. If he's not disposed to believe them, he doesn't. We all regularly do that, but he's not justified trusting, say, Polybius, but not the Paul the Apostle. He sounded more like he was quoting others who quoted others who made assertions, but did not demonstrate beyond reasonable doubt that their ideas of the past were valid. Anyway, thank you, Ken, with a stinging critique of Jonathan Pierce's a sort of way he handles the ancient documents there. J.D. Walters got in touch as well to say the discussion between Jonathan McClatchy and Pierce was a confusing one, and not just because of their names. They both made some good points. Jonathan McClatchy rightly noted that religiously significant signs must be, by definition, rare and spectacular, while Jonathan Pierce rightly noted that the same claim can be extraordinary for one person and mundane for another, depending on their background knowledge. But both also had very weak moments. Jonathan Pierce tried to disprove the whole Hebrew Bible in 30 seconds, while at one point Jonathan McClatchy frantically continued to simply read out the write-up of a miracle case, which Jonathan McClatchy had already noted did not challenge his own view. What was Jonathan McClatchy trying to do with that? Hope that the sheer amount of detail would distract from the criticism? Ultimately, I think the problem was that the conversation quickly turned, as it usually does, to debating the resurrection claim, not just whether something happened that surpasses the productive capacity of nature, but also who or what did it and why. This in turn raises all the issues surrounding the character and motivation of the God of the Bible, which then raises the problems of biblical accuracy, why God doesn't answer more prayers for healing, etc., etc. It's all just too much for one episode, especially when the question wasn't even, did the resurrection happen, but rather simply, do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? The fact is, the resurrection of Jesus is the hardest miracle claim to untangle for all of those reasons. And so if the discussion is just about miracles in general, it shouldn't be the one you start out with. That would be like trying to reconstruct general relativity in a high school physics class. If the question is about what amount and quality of attestation is required in order to believe a miracle happened, then there are less religiously charged examples to begin with. For example, take the mediumship of Leonora Piper, who over a period of decades was studied under extremely demanding conditions by very sceptical researchers, including Richard Hodgson and William James, and consistently showed knowledge of deceased people's lives and character that she was in no position to obtain via normal means. For this case, we have direct eyewitness testimony, which was recorded at the sittings as the sittings were happening over a long period of time. Now, although a Christian may not be quite sure what to make of this mediumship, as it did not occur in a religious context, at the very least it shows that there is a good contemporary evidence for at least some quote-unquote wonders. Jonathan McClatchy gestured towards this when he said that miracles in other religious contexts would at the very least prove a supernatural realm, which is enough to challenge atheism, even if it doesn't then prove specifically Christian miracle claims. It may result in less heat and more light if, at least in certain contexts, such as whether belief in miracles in principle can be rational, we don't immediately rush to discuss the most momentous one of all. Thank you very much, JD. Here's Phil Stillwell. Another atheist listener of the podcast says, I enjoyed the epistemic content on the miracles episode. I hope you can schedule more guests who can address epistemology. In particular, it'd be nice if we could pin down the orthodox position on the degree of belief necessary for salvation, since few, maybe zero, passages on salvation address this. Here are a few degrees of belief necessary for salvation that I've heard from various Christians. Firstly, absolute 100% belief. Secondly, assent, though I'm not sure what this means, since beliefs intrinsically fall on a gradient and assent appears to be a subjective threshold. 50% plus, or the faith of a mustard seed. Thank you, from Phil. I wonder if you've got an answer for Phil. You'd be welcome to send it in. Maybe finally one more from Erin, who says, I found the conversation thought-provoking. However, it ended up not being productive in answering the question, do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? The question is problematic because the extraordinary claims of Christianity are miracles, and miracles are only considered probable to those who believe in the existence of God. And once the existence of God has been established, then it makes sense to discuss miracles. Jonathan Beers rightly alluded to this when he said Jonathan McClatchy had to presuppose God in order to see the evidence as proof for a miracle. A more productive conversation between an atheist and a Christian would be one that discusses the existence of God, which, of course, has been done on Unbelievable before. It would be interesting to hear what people think miracles are and what purpose they serve, as well as what criteria may be counted as evidence. Thank you, Erin. And we have, of course, done discussions along those lines, and we've of course had that very interesting debate on miracles as well about around the Send Proof documentary a couple of weeks ago. But all good stuff. Thank you very much for getting in touch. Always enjoy hearing from you. For now, I'm going to say thank you for being with us and hope to see you next time. I'll tell you what's coming up on next week's show in just a moment's time. Just a reminder though, we'd love you to be with us in person for Philip Yancey on Tuesday the 1st of March, that webinar. Free to attend, you just need to register. And indeed, our Unbelievable conference. Check out the ticket options over there. There's even a pay what you want option for this year's conference, as we did last year. You can find out about it all at the website, unbelievable.live. For now, thanks for being with me. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. Hinduism, caste and Christianity is our subject. I'll be joined by Bishop Joseph D'Souza from the Good Shepherd Church in India and Kancha Alia Shepherd, political theorist and human rights activist, as they discuss the current political and religious climate in India, the situation for Christians there and for the Dalit and Shudra classes. Fascinating discussion on the show next week. Thanks for being with me. See you next time.